I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the heart of the Middle East. Tomorrow marks 1 year since the British EU-US armed airstrike on Iran via the Israeli bombing of Iran's embassy in Damascus, an act of war triggering Iran's first direct attack on Israel. A year later, Donald Trump, the so-called peace president, is wading deeper into escalation. His administration openly boasts about restarting Biden's war on Yemen, let alone its targeting of Iran and fostering of genocide in Gaza. Nevertheless, he is seeking peace in Europe and ending the imminent threat of thermonuclear world war. Simultaneously, he's due to introduce tariffs, he's liberalising crypto and calling on the Fed to slash interest rates. Joining me again is Professor Steve Hanke, who teaches applied economics at Johns Hopkins University. As well as an advisor to the US government, he has advised Argentina, Estonia, Bulgaria, Bosnia, Ecuador, Lithuania, Montenegro and, where I am, the UAE. He joins me now from Baltimore in Maryland. Professor Hanke, thanks so much for coming on. Before we get to interest rates and the idea of waiting in this important book you've released, I should just quickly mention Europe, because it's not that significant in anything else, arguably. What did you make of this anti-USA meeting in London, which wants European leaders to continue the proxy war on Russia through Ukraine? It's clearly already having a catastrophic impact on the economies of Western Europe.
Well, it's a little hard to figure out, because we have on the one hand a U.S. president who's talking peace in Ukraine, Russia, Europe, but on the other hand, the American president is talking war when it comes to the Middle East. Iran in particular seems to be a focal point. So it's a little bit confusing from the U.S. point of view. From the European point of view, it's just a yakking dog. I mean, there's absolutely no way that they can beef themselves up militarily and put a fighting force in the field without almost bankrupting the economies. We're talking economics here. All of these countries are in bad economic shape right now in Europe. And they're really going to go off the fiscal cliff if they ramp up the military spending as they contend that they're going to do. I mean, without the U.S. cover, forget Europe as a military force. It's kind of a bizarre, really.
Let's introduce your concept of waiting, because the new book talks about waiting. And, of course, some of those governments that you're saying have poor economies would say this military Keynesianism is built on waiting. This is a great idea to pour money into the idea of killing Russians but actually increasing your manufacturing base, albeit while slashing all the fabric of social civic life in terms of benefits for the elderly and the disabled.
Well, the book that you're mentioning is called Capital Interest in Waiting, and it's a treatise on capital theory that I wrote with Leland Yeager, who unfortunately isn't with us anymore. If he was with us, he would be 100 years of age today. So at any rate, I finished the project up. We started it in about 1976, so it's had a long gestation period. But capital theory is notorious for being perhaps the most controversial area in economics, because it holds the key to the explanation of profits. Capital is simply the center of all the laws of production and distribution in economics. So, Afshin, all the high priests of economics delve into it at one time or another in their life, and I guess I've delved into it here. We have waiting in that title. You mentioned waiting. And our new contribution here in this particular book is we've developed capital theory to the point where we can identify waiting as a factor of production. There are really three factors of production that make economies go around, three inputs: land, labor, and waiting. Now, what is waiting? Waiting is just a unit of consumption that's deferred for one unit at a time. So you don't consume today, you wait. You save and invest, and you wait to get a return and consume at some later point in time. Now, that waiting has a price. It's the interest rate. So waiting, like land is an input, rent is its price, labor is an input, wages are its price, and waiting is a factor of production, an input, and interest is its price. So it's that's kind of the theoretical, shall we say, backdrop to the thing. But the reality is, if the money supply has changed, if monetary policy changes and the money supply affects the interest rate, changes in the money supply affect the interest rate.
Professor, that's going to come up again and again because, you know, there'll be people watching this around the world, whether they're into modern monetary theory, MMT, there'll be Marxists out there all around the developing world. Just explain to us these indicators of money supply, because many people have forgotten them. Only people around during Thatcher and Reagan bothered with these numbers because they came out of fashion. And I know you love these indicators. You believe that they are levers, not byproducts. Tell us what M1, M2, M3, M4 are.
Well, okay, first of all, let's start with M sub zero, actually. M sub zero is the high-powered money that's produced at the Federal Reserve or a central bank. And then added to that, you get demand deposits and liquid deposits at commercial banks, and you've got M1. And then if you add to M1, retail money market accounts, small-time deposits, then you get M2, and so on until you get all the way out to M4. Now, officially, in the United States, they stopped reporting M3, and they never reported M4. But the Fed, the central bank, stopped reporting that in 2006. And part of
M3
the reason
is,
for that,
is current accounts, all of our current accounts and savings accounts.
Right.
Plus, plus long-term deposits of about $10,000 or something. Within advanced economies, they don't really count all this in developing world countries, arguably.
Well, here's the main thing to get that's true every place in the world, and that is the elephant in the room in terms of producing money that people hold in their liquidities is the commercial banking system. About 75%. Of all the M2 money, that's the broadest measure that the Fed reports, about 75% of the stock of M2 is actually money produced by commercial banks privately. It's not produced by the Federal Reserve. Most people look at central banks. They think they're the elephant in the room, but that's not the case. In almost every country, around 80% of broad money held by the non-bank public that they can spend, that makes the economy go around, that's actually produced by commercial banks. So when you take out a loan, Ashrin, from a commercial bank, what happens? They loan you the money and it goes into your checking account. And checking accounts are counted as part of the money supply. And commercial banks create those loans out of literally thin air.
They get a ratio of 5-1, I think, under the Basel Accord. Okay, now just because, you know, we haven't got a whole full seminar. How does that crucially impact on interest rates, the magnitude of these amounts of money in the M2 indicator, how everyone's mortgages and rental loan repayments and so on? How are interest rates?
There's kind of a two-step process. Let's assume that the monetary policy is loosened, and the money supply starts increasing. The first step is that the interest rates will go down, but then, with a lag, after the money supply is increased and interest rates go down, then inflation will come into the system and interest rates will go up. So that's the loosening process. If it's a tightening process, the first step, interest rates will go up, inflation will go down, and interest rates will go down. So it's people have trouble getting their heads around it because you have changes in the money supply, and those affect all kinds of asset prices, real economic activity, and ultimately inflation with long and variable lags. So what we see today when we look at the economic data are those data are things that have been determined by what's happened to the money supply a year ago, or maybe 2 years ago, maybe even 3 years ago.
Well, we'll get back to predictions, perhaps, in part two. But just on that, given the importance that you give private enterprises rather than the evil Fed, as it were, I don't think you mentioned much in the book about the fact that, I mean, where I'm from, London, it's famous for fraud when it comes to interest rate setting. The LIBOR rate famously implicating Deutsche Bank, Barclays, Citigroup, JP Morgan, Chase, RBS. So some people, cynics, might say interest rates are just coordinated by a few oligarch-owned or involved banks in the first place, and the manipulation occurs there rather than the... with the actual rate, per se, rather than the amount of debt being issued by the bank in loans?
Well, now, to a certain extent, you're right. The very short-term interest rates are influenced by this monetary policy and primarily the central bank. But longer-term rates follow inflation. They don't lead inflation. Inflation... first, you have the following sequence, Efren. The money supply changes, then eventually it works through the system, is transmitted through the system, and inflation changes. And if inflation goes up, the interest rates go up. The yields on bonds follow the interest rates. If inflation is going down, the interest rates on long-term duration bonds will go down. So in the short term, the short duration things, the interest rate is managed and manipulated, if you want, controlled by and largely influenced by the central bank. But longer term rates, that's not the case.
And how do we factor in Trump's tariffs and the sanctions policies of successive governments in NATO countries and their impact on their own economies, let alone the economies they're targeting?
Well, the first thing, there's a lot of talk about the Trump tariffs will cause inflation to go up. That's not the case. Inflation is determined by changes in the money supply. So looking at the money supply in the United States right now, the stock of money, M2, we were talking about M2, Efren, that actually is lower now in the United States than it was in the summer of 2022. That means what? That means that inflation will continue to go down this year. It's now at 2.9%. Using the quantity theory of money, I predicted that at the end of last year it would be between 2.5 and 3%. It's actually ended up at 2.9%. I think this year will go down and probably hit the target of 2% that the Fed has, maybe even slightly lower. And that's baked in the cake because the baking occurred with a change in the money supply that was occurring a couple of years ago. And so that's determining inflation, the aggregate measure of inflation.
That's the lag. I'll stop you there, Professor Steve Hagke. More from the John Hopkins Applied Economics Professor and former senior economist to President Reagan's Council of Economic Advisors after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the Johns Hopkins Applied Economics Professor, who has advised the UAE government and who co-wrote the newly released Capital Interest and Weighting, Professor Steve Hanke. Professor Hanke, you were predicting actually not such a bad economy in the next few quarters based on the CPI, based on the M2 money supply indicator. I'm sure you know what Scott Bessent and the Trump administration may want to point to and say, look, M2 isn't a good indicator. Of course, it's a good indicator across, say, 20, 30 years, but it was exactly inversely related in 2022 to 2023. The economy's changed. I mean, there is no correlation between M2 and GDP growth and CPI between 2022 and 2023. I think it's actually inverse.
Well, no, that's not right. I use the quantity theory of money, and I was one of the few economists with John Greenwood that was able to predict that inflation would go up to a peak of 9%, we said. It actually went up to 9.1%. Now, why was that, Avshalom? That was because when COVID hit in February of 2020, the Fed stepped on the accelerator, and actually the money supply started growing at a very rapid rate. It peaked out. It was growing actually at 18% year over year, the fastest rate of growth in the money supply since the Fed was founded in 1913.
Yeah, so you'd expect a much bigger rise. And by December of 2022, it had lowered markedly, hadn't it?
That's true. But you get the you're not following the lags in there. You goose the money supply, and what happens? The inflation went up exactly as Greenwood and I predicted, and also the economy boomed just as we predicted. Then the Fed threw everything into reverse. In 2022, and the money supply started going down. Now, inflation with a lag started going down. And as I indicated, we predicted exactly where it was going to be at the end of last year. And I think we'll be right on target this year. The thing we didn't get is that the economy has not started to substantially slow down yet. I think it will this year because of this contraction in the money supply. So things don't really look that great in the United States. They look great on in the inflation part of the thing, but the real economy is starting to slow down. And that's because the contraction in the money supply has occurred. That's only happened four times since the Fed was founded in 1913. And every single one of those contractions was followed eventually with a lag by a recession, and in one case, by a Great Depression, 1929, 1933. So the money supply is very important. The quantity theory of money is the only reliable model for national income determination. And what that means is to determine where nominal GDP is going, and nominal GDP includes a real component plus an inflation component.
Okay,
you add real growth to inflation.
Well, I mean, what would you say to critics that would say you're just changing the lag time to suit the explanation? I mean, I'm sure you go to conferences where you're come across opponents of this theory of money, it has no predictive power. It's just cumulative fiscal expansion. You're looking at a byproduct of fiscal stimulus rather than the lever, and saying, oh, it's the lever that's doing it.
No, it's money that's doing it. Money always dominates. If you get fiscal policy and monetary policy going in opposite directions, the monetary policy will be the thing that dominates. Now, think of, for example, Japan. Japan has had very loose fiscal policy ever since 1990 and run up massive deficits and debt. The world's largest debt to GDP ratio is where? It's in Japan. But they've had essentially no growth for 30 years and no inflation for 30 years because the money supply is almost not growing at all. Let's go to Russia, for example. Now, Russia has a little problem now. They have inflation of 10.1% right now. The target inflation rate is 4%. So the inflation is over double what the target is in Russia. Why is that? That's because the money supply is growing at 19.2% year over year. And to be consistent with a 4% target, Hanke's golden growth rate for Russia would be 8.4%. So
what do you advise? Massive cuts
should be growing at 8.4% to hit a 4% inflation.
Yeah, but how do you
target?
Cut the money supply? You cut the money supply from a government standpoint, aside from obviously the private sector, by hurting the poorest in your society, don't you?
Well, you're hurting the poorest in society. Big
either way.
By the inflation tax. Inflation is a tax, and it's a very regressive tax. It taxes the poor more than the rich. Who gained, by the way, when we had the huge inflation and money supply expansion in the United States after the pandemic? It was the rich, because the money supply got goosed. When the money supply gets goosed with a lag, asset prices go up. And who owns the assets? The rich do. And if you looked at billionaires' wealth as a percent of GDP in 2020, February, when the COVID hit, right before they started goosing the money supply, their wealth as a percent of GDP in the United States for billionaires is 14.1%. Now it's 21.1%. The billionaires made out like bandits with the inflation. All the asset prices went up. Land went up. Stock market went up. Real estate went up. Any hard asset went up with the inflation. But the poor people took it in the ear because they don't own many assets. Most poor people are actually in debt.
Yeah, but of course, the rich make it both ways around the top, because even if M2 is going down, as you see from growing inequalities in late capitalist countries, they go up anyway. It doesn't. I mean, I saw the troubled asset relief program money in Hampton.
I would argue that the biggest contributor to income inequality in the United States has been the Federal Reserve. That is the main thing. The main thing is what's going on with the changes in the money supply, which change asset prices. And this the numbers that I just gave you for the billionaires' wealth as a percent of GDP, there's just been nothing like it. This is just absolutely phenomenal. And where did it come from? It came from the Fed. It didn't come from the fiscal stimulus, because the fiscal stimulus would have never done anything to inflation if the Treasury bonds that were sold to finance the huge deficit that started after the pandemic were not sold to the Fed. The Fed bought those. And when the Fed buys the bonds, the money goes where? The credit ends up going to the non-bank public. It increases the money supply. If the Fed had sat on their hands and not done anything, and the Fed the Treasury would have had to sell all those bonds to the public, we wouldn't have had an inflation.
Do you think Trump understands the theory of waiting in your new book better than any other president, because he's a real estate businessman, or he doesn't? He obviously just wants interest rates to be slashed, and he's upping the budget for military Keynesianism, a new war plane. But he often talks about infrastructural spending.
Well, the answer is no. I don't think he does, because he's not the kind of guy who'd read Capital Interest in Waiting. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, but he understands the crucial axiomatic role that interest plays and waiting plays. And I should say, for people in Islamic banking, it still factors out within Islamic banking as well. And I know you advise the UAE government.
Trump understands interest rates that part of it, because he is a real estate guy. And if interest rates go down, by the way, the present value of an asset goes up. So if interest rates go down, real estate goes up.
That's why he likes it. Look, Trump was very quick, right in the early days after his inauguration, to threaten BRICS countries about de-dollarization. I understand you're in favor of perhaps a gold-backed BRICS currency. I mean, it, you know, some might say they lost the ball already, because the time to do that would have been during a genocide Joe Biden administration, not under, you know, it's too late now, arguably, to sort it all out. But tell me about that.
Well, okay. So the BRICS have rhetorically said that they would like to have their own currency, but it's just rhetoric. They have no game plan. There is no plan in the drawer they can pull out. I have presented a plan and published it, actually, for a gold-backed currency I'm recommending for Turkey, Iran, and Russia. It would be very suitable for those three. And it would be issued by a currency board, and the currency board would issue the currency, and the currency would be backed 100% with gold reserves, and it would trade at a fixed exchange rate with gold. And the currency, the paper currency, or the digital currency, whatever currency form that it comes out in, it would be a clone of gold, because, and it would be credible, because you could take your paper, your ruble in, and exchange it at a fixed rate and get a fixed amount of gold under the currency board arrangement. Now, this was, according to my models, actually my proposal in the law that I drafted up, which was, as I say, published, brought up with the Turks, Iranians, and Russians in the Kremlin, but it never went anyplace.
But theoretically, because of the great technological advances, the tokenization of such a plan would be even easier if governments in Moscow or Ankara had the guts to do it.
It'd be a no-brainer. It would be just like the currency board I set up in Bulgaria in 1997. Inflation was roaring away at 242% a month in July of 1997. We issued the lev under a currency board arrangement. It was backed 100% by Deutschmark reserves. It traded at a fixed exchange rate freely. Lev, Deutschmark, Deutschmark, lev. Inflation was crushed within 30 days. A year later, money market interest rates were down at 2%. The foreign exchange reserves had doubled. These things never fail.
Professor Hanke.
They're foolproof.
Professor Steve Hanke, thank you.
Thank you, Ashram. Great to be with you.
And that's it for the show. Capital, Interest and Waiting is out now. We'll be back on Saturday with a brand new episode. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.